This podcast is brought to you by eHarmony, the dating app to find someone you can be yourself with. Why doesn't eHarmony allow copy and paste in first messages? Because you are unique, and your conversations should reflect that. eHarmony wants you to find someone who will get you. How are you going to know who gets you? If people send you the same generic conversation starters, they message everyone else. Conversations that actually help you get to know each other. Imagine that. Get who gets you on eHarmony. Sign up today.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Welcome to Condensed Histories, the podcast that takes pop culture and reveals the real history underneath. I'm your host, Jem Deducci, and this time round, we are, for the first time ever, doing a part two of an episode.
We're doing a sequel. We're back by popular demand.
So this is the one time I'll say, if this is your first episode of Condensed Histories, hello, hi, pleased to meet you, but either just grab a random episode previously just to get a flavor for it, but definitely listen to part one, because boy, are you going to miss out on 45 minutes of important context here. So I started with Warhammer and talked about how they keep going on crusades, and then that leads to, well, what exactly are the crusades? So in part one, I talked about the very early parts of the crusading concepts and the idea of just war, and then I moved on to the first crusade and just finished at the end of the first crusade. Now, I am going to quickly go back to the Warhammer element to it as well, but then I will very quickly jump into the history because we got a lot of history to do. So the thing about the Crusades in Warhammer is they keep going, they keep moving. And if you look at the history, it's like those are true. But then when they took areas, they turned them into their thing. And that's the thing that doesn't get talked about so much in the Warhammer elements. But the idea, as I previously said, and I did a whole episode specifically on the military orders, they will be coming up again. But the military orders are a direct influence on the likes of the Black Templars or the Space Marines as a whole. And so it really fits in very well. And I keep talking about Warhammer 40,000, but there's also Age of Sigmar as well. You've got all this, as I said, the Dawnbringer Crusades and various other things. The idea of the religious imperative of Sigmar pushing themselves forwards, but there are the religious elements of the Chaos as well. Jumping all the way back to 140,000, there are the Black Crusades carried out by Chaos. But the idea of the Chaos Gods fighting and killing for the Chaos Gods, classically the chant for Khorne, one of the Chaos Gods, is blood for the blood god. That's not far off things like Deus Vult in the real world. God wills it, as chanted in the First Crusade. Warhammer is all over this, and the iconography fits really well. This idea that we are killing, but we are killing for good, religious, holy reasons. That's an important concept to be taken into the Crusades. So, just a little bit of pop culture there, because I don't want to be accused of completely throwing it to one side. We also get things like the very first Assassin's Creed game is set specifically during the Third Crusade. And as somebody who's always been fascinated by the Crusades, it was amazing going through the city of Acre. And while I recognise that it had been gamified, clearly attention had been paid as to this is the sort of layout of a medieval city in the Middle East. Really just is so evocative. Loved it to bits. So the Crusades absolutely have influenced so many things. And when we get to the Third Crusade, that is quite often the background of the Robin Hood legends. It's so important, people coming back from Crusades, etc. I'm going to stop with that. Let's move on. Because doing my bridge from Warhammer to the world of the Crusades is, now that we have these Christian territories in the Middle East, you've got it for the average peasant farming in the fields, nothing's changed. Your lord has gone from being a Muslim overlord to now a Christian overlord. There were still your five calls to prayer every day. There were still mosques open. In a way, not a lot changed. But obviously, from the perspective of the imperatives of the West, things had changed massively. There was now Holy Land was open for business for Christians. It had been previously as well, but now they were in charge of the Christian sites. They made sure that no other religious structures were taller than the churches in places like Jerusalem, for example. That sort of pettiness has been around for centuries. It happened while it was under Jewish control. It happened under Muslim control. Oh, the churches can't be taller than the mosques. It's all very petty, all very silly. It shows you that how human these metaphysical ideas of religion actually are. But the other thing you needed to do was actually man. Where's the personnel? Because the problem with the crusade is not everybody who went on crusade stayed in the Middle East. An example I gave in the previous episode was the Duke of Normandy, Robert. He went back to becoming Duke of Normandy, except he lost a battle with his brother and ended up being thrown into prison. But there you go. So the fundamental problem of these Christian lands in the Middle East is they always had a problem with manpower. Yeah, you could hire local mercenaries, but how loyal are they going to be? They're Muslim and they fight the same way as the Turks and the Arabs, etc. So really interesting that. Therefore, there were these military orders. Again, as I said, done a whole episode on them. For full details, listen to that. But principally, at least at this time, we start off with the Hospitallers, then we get the Templars, the Knights Templar. And these groups lived in religious groups, like monks. They would take a vow of poverty and chastity, and the Hospitallers literally would tend to sick pilgrims, you know, which is where we get the word hospital from. The Templars did similar things. But when they weren't doing that, rather than necessarily praying all the time and writing up manuscripts all the time, like a literal monk would do in Europe, they would fight for God. So they built amazingly complex, some of the best fortifications and castles in the world were created by the military orders during their time in the crusading era. Probably the greatest castle ever. And, you know, obviously gunpowder is going to make all of this stuff redundant, but is Cractus Chevalier in modern day Syria. It's on a big mound in the middle of a valley, so you can see from miles around. Nobody's going to be able to sneak up on Cractus Chevalier. Some of its walls are 70 feet thick. It has got a great concentric layout, and with a few dozen members of the military orders, they were able to hold off an entire army. This is towards the end of the crusading era, for months. That's how good it was. But more importantly, you've got people like Lawrence of Arabia in World War I commenting on it and writing about it and using it as a supply depot. And today, in the Syrian civil war, it has been used by the likes of Al-Qaeda and ISIS as bases. It's sadly been attacked by artillery and munitions, which is horrible and terrible. It is one of the places I would absolutely love to go to, or at least would have done before the Syrian civil war, and certainly after the Syrian civil war, but I'm not sure how much of it will be left. But for it to still be used in the 21st century, the era of drone warfare and cruise missiles still being used as a defensive base, shows you how well built it is and what a great location they picked. So they've got these castles, and the thing is, with the Crusaders, they fundamentally in the Middle East have this problem of they have enough men to gather an army to fight a pitch battle, or they have enough men to man all of these fortifications. But if they lose a lot of men in a battle, they're not going to have very many men to defend the fortifications, and so everything's going to fall like a house of cards. Remember that in the year 1145, so we are talking quite a long way after the First Crusade, pushing on for 50 years, 1145 to 1149, we get the Second Crusade. And this is remembered as a complete disaster. It's a little bit more complicated than that. So, for example, the English contingent decide to go on ships, and they travel from England to the Middle East via the Iberian Peninsula. And they actually join in with Christian forces besieging Lisbon, which is obviously the capital of Portugal today. And they help out and they win the siege of Lisbon, pushing out the Muslims who had been there for 400 years, something like that. This is a major deal. It's a major city that had been Muslim for a long time, centuries, and now the Christians recapture it. And from that point onwards, it never gets recaptured by Muslim powers. So the fact that Lisbon today is the capital city of Portugal is thanks to the Second Crusade. And I think we have to chalk that up as a success. However, critically, You may remember I said that with the First Crusade, the critical thing was that these people weren't kings, and therefore they would turn up and actually become the administrators of the areas of the Holy Land. This time round, we've got kings and emperors turning up. Importantly, we've got Frederick Barbarossa as a prince turning up. He's a very young man on the Second Crusade. He's going to be a very big deal on the Third Crusade, but that's decades later. There he is on the Second Crusade, but you have the King of France turning up. And what happens is they all turn up into the Middle East, and there's this discussion with the local powers of like, so where is this crusade? Where is this injection of a new army going to do the most good? And they said, well, you know, we really need to expand south into what we would now consider the Sinai Peninsula, and, you know, perhaps on into Egypt. And the kings were like, that isn't going to get much praise back home. It's like, you captured Gaza. That's not a thing that means anything in the West. And they went, how about Damascus? And the local powers went, no, don't go for Damascus, because Damascus is an Islamic power, but it's the only Islamic power that is willing to treat us neutrally. They're not out to attack us or anything like that. Everywhere else is under the Zengid dynasty. They've got it in for us. Please don't attack Damascus. But the Second Crusade went, but Damascus is so close. And also, everybody in the West has heard of Damascus. You've got Paul's conversion on the road to Damascus. It's an important thing in the Bible. We should go for Damascus. No, please don't go for Damascus. That's our only ally in the area. So what did they do? They went for Damascus. Also, they then realized how big Damascus was, and they did not have enough troops to surround it. So what did they decide to do? And I'm not making this up. They decided to sun themselves in the lemon groves outside of Damascus, or could stay in the shade of the lemon groves, and make lemonade, which is delicious and kept them cool, but doesn't get on with the actual siege of Damascus. The actual emir of Damascus was so terrified of this new army coming out of nowhere for no good reason that he was forced to ally himself with the other enemy Islamic powers, and so they ended up leaving, having done nothing other than weaken the position of the Westerners in the Middle East. Well done, Second Crusade. So the reason why people don't talk a lot about the Second Crusade is because it's an utter failure, and there aren't any sort of epic battles involved with it, really, apart from the Siege of Lisbon. Again, quite important. One of the triggers for the Second Crusade is, again, you've got the County of Edessa in the top, then to the next one down you get the Principality of Antioch, you get the County of Tripoli, and finally the Kingdom of Jerusalem at the bottom. The County of Edessa, which is the furthest one into enemy territory and therefore the most vulnerable one, had fallen to Islamic powers. And once it fell, it was never recaptured again. So that went, we've got the Second Crusade doing absolutely nothing. So then we get the rise of one, I won't bother doing his whole name, but everybody's heard of Saladin. And Saladin was a Kurd, so he's neither an Arab nor a Turk. He is his own ethnic group, but very much a proud Muslim. And the thing that's forgotten about Saladin is he had to fight his way to the top. He wasn't the heir to the throne. So actually, although he might have been a Ghazi, which means a sort of just warrior fighting for Islam, he actually spent more campaigning fighting against enemy Muslim powers than actually Christians. But obviously he did spend some time fighting the Christians as well. One of the key things, there's this really interesting TV show, one of these very sensationalized history programs called Warrior Graveyard. It's available on Disney Plus. And the second episode of season one of Warrior Graveyard is around Jacob's Ford. And this was a battle at a Templar fortification. Do you remember I said that these things were being built by the Templars? Now, it's called Jacob's Ford, and the situation was it hadn't been completed yet. So clearly, Saladin's forces recognized, well, we know how good the Crusaders are at building this stuff. We need to get rid of it before it becomes a permanent thorn in our side. And there was a fight there. And what Warrior Graveyard does is they actually exhume some of the skeletons, some of the bodies of long ago battles, and then using forensic archaeology, they can work out how these people died. And so they know they got bodies of Knights Templar. And what's interesting is it isn't like, oh, took an arrow into the heart, dead. No, what happened is every single body took multiple wounds. One guy had his arm cut off and still took a blow as well. So it shows you how, with what zeal the Knights Templar fought, that they were willing to, they were able to fight through horrifying wounds to themselves, and clearly from the Islamic perspective, it's like, these guys aren't going down. They're clad in this really thick armor. These are sort of religious fanatics from the Islamic perspective point of view. These guys will just, you know, how many times do we have to stab them before they go down? So Jacob's Ford 1179 shows you that there is this increasing threat to the Holy Land. And then we get in 1187, critically, the Battle of Hattin. This is the critical one. Now, I do have to say, just before the Battle of Hattin, we get Baldwin IV, King of Jerusalem. And Baldwin IV is in the movie Kingdom of Heaven. This is a Ridley Scott movie about round about the Third Crusade. And Ridley's jinxed around with the time a bit. Let's face it, he's not renowned for just sticking to the actual history. And so he's at a time when he's already dead. But I don't blame Ridley, because Baldwin IV is, again, one of these people that's like, really? That's a real thing? Baldwin IV was known as the Leper King. He was born with leprosy, and he ended up becoming hideously disfigured. He was able to carry out a really effective battle early on in his career as king, and he became king as a boy. So he's a teenage boy with leprosy, but he was able to lead forces against a much larger force of Saladin's army. And because he caught Saladin's army while it was out of formation, while it was marching, he was able to use his forces really effectively and really shatter Saladin's forces. It pushed back Saladin's plans by years and was a great victory for the Crusader kingdoms. Towards the end of his life, because he obviously was unable to have children, that means that his bloodline finishes with him. There's then a squabble over who gets to be the next king of Jerusalem. But he had to wear a silver mask over his face to cover up his disfigurement. I mean, this sounds like it should be in a fantasy movie, but it's actually real history. So Baldwin IV did cause a problem. And like I say, it just shows you this tensions between the Islamic powers and the Christian powers. Of course, the Islamic powers never knew when another crusade was going to turn up with suddenly like a magic another 25,000 heavily armored troops. Like I said, there was an argument over who gets to be the king of Jerusalem. In the face of this unified enemy, the Christian states squabbled like little children. And this is the thing that's so frustrating that happens again and again. It's like, really? Can you not unify? There is a greater threat to you. Oh, no, you're going to remember I was besmirched at this feast or whatever. So what happens is Saladin goads the Crusader forces into gathering together all of their forces. Remember what I said about that? So they gather together all of their forces, and he meets them at the Horns of Hattin, these two mountains that kind of look like the devil's horns. And Saladin has made sure that all of the wells leading up to this location of his army have been poisoned, so the Crusader forces are unable to take on any more water. It's in the blazing heat of the Middle East. He sets fire to any shrubbery in the area, so there's literally fire added to the hot sun, added to the lack of thirst. And so what happens is the Crusader forces meet Saladin at Hattin, and they charge the heavy cavalry at his light cavalry, and the light cavalry have room for maneuver. They open up. Heavy cavalry are charging slightly uphill, so they're beginning to tire. They miss their mark. They miss the light cavalry. Then the light cavalry reform, and now the heavy cavalry are exhausted, out of shape, and separated from the rest of the army. And I think you can guess what happened next. So the Christian forces are absolutely shattered. You know, many of them are slaughtered or sold into slavery. And then Saladin starts rolling everything up. He captures Jerusalem. That's kind of what the Kingdom of Heaven movie's about. He then starts capturing all of the other cities. And really, there is one Crusader city on the coast left. So when Saladin arrives in Jerusalem, this is the opposite of what happens in the First Crusade. He arrives and he allows everybody to leave. A few people are put into slavery, but everybody leaves. There is no massacre going on. So this is the thing. The Muslims, by and large, behave better than the Christians in the Middle East. Because Jerusalem has now fallen, we get the call to the Third Crusade. And what happens is the King of France, the King of England, and the Emperor of Germany, the Holy Roman Emperor, Frederick Barbarossa, who had been a young man on the Second Crusade, he is now determined to get it right on the Third Crusade. He gathers a gigantic army of about 70,000. And he marches across Europe. He goes on into Anatolia. And then what happens is, just as he's passing from Anatolia into the Middle East proper, into Syria proper, he crosses a minor river, falls off his horse, and drowns in a river. Whoopsie! And so, not all, but 95% of that German army goes, well, our leader's gone, we're going home. Frederick was always meant to be the senior partner of the Third Crusade, but now the main force of the Third Crusade is gone. So what's left is the King of France and the King of England. They're not exactly allies. You've got Richard, the Lionheart of England. He's literally been fighting in France, taking over Philip Augustus's, the King of France's, lands. But this is the thing. As I've said many times before, Richard the Lionheart is a terrible King of England, but he's an excellent general. And everything he does in the Middle East, he wins. He wins the Siege of Acre. And he uses innovative ideas of ironclad siege towers. You know, those things that you see again in sort of ridiculous movies, you think, oh, those aren't real things. No, those are actual real things. And Acre itself has double ring, double layered walls. It's an incredibly well-defended city. He manages to win that. There is then a pitch battle between him and Saladin. He wins that. He then carries out a daring raid against the city of Jaffa. And he manages to storm that with an elite group of knights. So no matter what he does, he wins. But he then is told by the advisors that they do not have enough forces to capture Jerusalem. And so he brokers a deal with Saladin. They never actually meet. And in the midst of all of this awesomeness, Philip Augustus of France says, well, I'm going home then. And as soon as he goes home, there is now a ticking clock for Richard, because he knows that all that Philip's going to do is start retaking his lands back in France again. So there is a sell-by date to all of this. So he manages to broker a deal that anybody who wants to go on pilgrimage to Jerusalem can do unmolested, but it's still going to remain Muslim. But Richard himself says, I will not visit Jerusalem if I cannot capture it. And the thing is, what the Christians say is, maybe you can capture it, but we don't have enough men to hold it, so there's no point doing it. So what Richard does is he spends perhaps more time than he should have done reinforcing this much more diminished lands in the Middle East. But whereas the Second Crusade made everything weaker, the Third Crusade made everything stronger, and indeed it was going to last another 100 years or so. So the Third Crusade is from 1189 to 1192, and famously, Richard, on the way back from the Crusade, ends up getting captured in Austria and ends up being held for ransom, which is hugely embarrassing for the papacy, because the one thing you should never do is kidnap a pilgrim or indeed somebody who's been on crusade. And so the Germans and the Austrians get into hot water over that. But that's the Third Crusade. What's interesting is just slightly before the Third Crusade, we get a period that gets referred to as the Northern Crusades. Now, the Northern Crusades have been largely forgotten for a number of different reasons. First of all, it doesn't fit into the narrative of this is Christian versus Muslim. And secondly, this went on for centuries after the Crusades in the Middle East. And also, it's involving countries, say, today who are very proudly Christian, who don't like to admit that they might not have always been that way. I literally had an argument. So the Northern Crusades start round about 1171. So it's about a decade before all this stuff I was telling you about leading up to the Third Crusade. And what it is, this is the weird thing, Estonia, the modern country of Estonia, back in the 1170s, was an epicenter of the Wends, which is the last pagan group in Europe, major pagan civilization. And I know that's weird to say in the 1170s, but them's the facts. And so you get these Christian forces pushing their way into, first of all, Estonia, but then on into other areas, you know, such as Lithuania, and then further east into modern-day Belarusia. And it's sometimes against pagans, or sometimes it's against Orthodox Christians. So you've got this defunct area called Novgorod, which takes up chunks of modern-day Russia, Belarusia, and Ukraine, and perhaps bits of Poland as well. This all was part of Novgorod. And those military orders, I mentioned Hospitallers and Templars. Well, another military order is created because of this called the Teutonic Knights. It's where we get the idea Teutonic means German. Everything the Hospitallers and Templars were doing in the Middle East, the Teutonic Knights were doing in Northern Europe. Only the difference was the Teutonic Knights did end up sending forces into the Middle East, but also these areas were to be administered by the Teutonic Knights into the Renaissance era and sometimes beyond. Elements of what is Prussia and what is Teutonic gets very murky and muddy. And some of these people had to be sort of deposed into the Age of Enlightenment. This is how long this influence would last in these regions. Now, Poland is a very proudly Catholic country to this day. But if you're talking about northeastern Poland, that would have been part of the Teutonic Crusades. And they were introduced to Catholicism as opposed to paganism then. Now, I'm not saying all of Poland was like that, but that was the argument I had online. It's like, how dare you say that Poland was part of the Northern Crusades? Okay, you're right in the sense that not all of modern-day Poland was, but to pretend that parts weren't, and the fact that the borders of Poland have been moved around more than probably any other country in Europe, it's a complicated, nuanced conversation rather than just getting angry with you.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Me, so please take my point. I'm seeing this from a historical point of view. I'm not trying to offend Polish nationalists in any way. But the Northern Crusades, in a way, were almost the complete opposite, because in the Middle East, it's lots of dry, open, arid land. You kind of know where everything is. You know where Damascus is on the map. Whereas here, you're in dense, thick pine forests where people can freeze to death. And pushing forwards, we get something like 1242. You get the Battle of Priapus, or the Battle on Ice. And this is a bunch of heavy Teutonic cavalry fighting a Novgorodian, largely infantry force, which has less of everything. The thing about the military orders is they were the best funded, best trained, best equipped forces in Europe. They were the absolute elite. And so when you've got the Teutonic Knight heavy cavalry versus this ragtag bunch of auxiliary infantry, it's obvious who's going to win there. But their leader, Alexander Nevsky, who is a hero in the Slavic world, Nevsky was used as propaganda in the Soviet Union, for example. He's powerful to, even though he'd have no idea what the Soviet Union was, or even the whole of modern-day Russia, never would have heard of something like Vladivostok or St. Petersburg or anything like that. But he tried to defend his area from these very aggressive Teutonic knights, and geniusly, he managed to lure these knights onto a frozen lake, Lake Priapus, which is, I believe, in modern-day Belarus. He gets the Teutonic knights onto it, which is, in a way, the knights don't have a problem with this. It's thick ice and it's flat, so it's perfect for a cavalry charge. But what they don't know is that Alexander Nevsky manages to maneuver to a position so that the knights end up moving across a thin part of ice, and then this heavy cavalry just collapses into it, and hundreds of these elite soldiers, and these take a long time to replace, die, and the horses die, and there's utter panic, and it's a huge victory for Novgorod and one of the most humiliating defeats for the Teutonic Knights. Centuries later, there's the Battle of Tannenberg, again against the sort of Novgorodians and the Teutonic Knights, and the Novgorodians win. The Battle of Tannenberg was such a humiliating defeat in the eyes of the Germanic psyche that when a battle was fought very near that site in World War I, it was called the Second Battle of Tannenberg because they absolutely annihilate the Russian imperial forces. That shows you the echoes. The Crusades absolutely have potency in European society, whether you're Christian or not. But this is all going on throughout the rest of everything else I'm going to mention in this episode. Then we get to the Fourth Crusade, 1202 to 1204. And this is where they've begun to innovate. They have shown through the likes of Frederick Barbarossa dying and various other crusades just marching, it takes a lot of energy and is very dangerous to march armies from Western Europe to the Middle East across modern-day Turkey, Anatolia. So let's do it by ship. So they go to Venice and say, hey, Venice, we need this many ships to ship out a whole bunch of our forces, and we're going to attack Egypt because that seems to be the power base, the epicenter of Islamic power. All of this makes sense on paper. The Venetians say, well, rather than trading, we're going to have to spend our time only building boats. So we have to charge you for this. We can't do it for free. And they're like, not a problem. As the Crusaders turn up, they'll pay for it. And all the Crusaders are told that they need to raise money for these ships. The problem is, not enough Crusaders turn up for the Fourth Crusade. So they can't pay their bills. And Venice goes, well, you know, we built the ships. You owe us. So they go, well, how about you do us a favor? So in modern day Croatia, there's this town called Zara, which is actually a trading competitor to us in Venice. How about you guys take over Zara for us and we'll call it Even Stevens? And the Crusaders go, well, hang on, remind us, what religion are these people of Zara? Oh, they're Christian, they're Catholic Christian. Well, the whole point of Crusaders is we're not meant to attack Christians. Oh, don't worry about it. And so when the Pope Innocent III, brilliant name, Innocent III is going to appear in a few of these. He's not so innocent, is his simple answer. When Pope Innocent III hears of this, he excommunicates the crusade. Now, as I said, the whole point of going on crusade is you're guaranteed to go to heaven. Excommunication means that you're outside the church now and you're guaranteed to go to hell. So how can you excommunicate a crusade? It is a real dichotomy. The papal legate gets involved, letters go backwards and forwards, and in the end, the crusade does capture Zara, and the people of Zara were literally hung flags with the cross on it to remind the crusaders that they were attacking Christians. This is just awful, okay? And even the crusaders, some of the crusaders just go home going, this is not what I signed up for. I signed up to fight for Christianity, to recapture Jerusalem, you know, for these glory things. And it's like, this is not glorious at all. This is just another European war. And so the number of troops dwindle. For a time, they're excommunicated. Then they come back again. They capture Zara. And then this pretender to the throne of Byzantium turns up and goes, hey guys, I happen to notice you got a ready-to-go army. Why don't you help me reclaim my birthright and capture Constantinople? And think of all the money and gold and resources I can give you if you help me take Riza. You'll have an emperor on your side. Then you'll really do a brilliant job in the Middle East and Egypt. And so there's humming and hawing about over that. And then eventually they go, all right, fine, we'll do it. And the Venetians also really want to be involved in this because opening up Constantinople to Venetian trade will give them monopoly against the Genoese. The Venetians are all over this. And so the blind doge, Venice is a republic, it doesn't have a king, it has a doge, think of it as a prime minister. The blind doge, Enrico Dandolo, who's a man in his 70s and blind, he literally goes along on this. And they turn up at Constantinople, it turns into an impasse, they kind of besiege it, but then they sort of trick their way into it. It's called the sacking of Constantinople rather than the siege of Constantinople. They're in 1204. This wannabe is installed. He isn't loved by anybody, by the Byzantines. He's eventually overthrown. The whole thing is a big bloody mess. And then the crusade ends up taking over the Byzantine Empire. It's called the Latin Empire or Eastern Latin Empire for about 50 years. You think, okay, that's it, the end of the Byzantine Empire. But actually, the remainders of the Byzantine aristocracy have been holding out in a place called Trebizond, which is on the northern coast of the Black Sea coast of Anatolia, and they end up making a comeback 50 years later. It's bizarre and insane, but that's that. Again, you couldn't write this stuff. You couldn't make it up. But the Fourth Crusade, when they sack Constantinople, they set fire to hundreds of houses and things like that. It's seen as an absolute war crime. We talk about, you have to put it into context. People at the time were disgusted by this. So the whole of the Fourth Crusade is very embarrassing. And ironically, in the summer of 2024, I'm going on an Eastern Mediterranean cruise, which the rest of the family are describing it as an Eastern Mediterranean cruise. And I'm describing it as, we seem to be going on the same route as the Fourth Crusade. It's like, only you, Jem, could say that. But I'm really looking forward to it. Starting off in Venice, then we're going to Zara. I'm really excited about it. Anyway, but then shortly after this, in 1209, we get something called the Albigensian Crusade. Again, not very well remembered because this breaks it again. In the south of France, you've got this heresy. Now, there's been recent research into this that leads to maybe this heresy was far more exaggerated by the papacy than it ever truly existed. But I'm going to stick with the basic idea that there were people who weren't at least following standard Christian doctrine called the Cathars. And so northern France didn't like that and therefore decided to declare war on southern France. So really what it was northern France trying to impose its will on southern France. But it was jazzed up as a crusade. We're doing this for God and for the Pope. It had a papal legate. It follows it. But this is the longest single campaign of crusading in history. It goes from 1209 to 1229. Again, Innocent III says, this is okay. You go ahead and do it. And to give you an idea, in 1225, you get the siege of Béziers, and the crusaders are on the outside, and allegedly so the Catholics, but also some good Christian Catholics and the Cathars are on the inside, and they manage to break in. And then there is a question from the crusaders breaking in. It's all like, well, how do we know who's a Cathar and how do we know who's a good Christian? And the papal legate, a guy called Arnaud Amaric, says this. This has been preserved in the chronicles. Kill them all, for God shall know his own. So the idea is, well, if we massacre everybody, all of the innocents, it's like a post-death filtering system, all of the good Christians will go to heaven, and all the bad Christians will go to hell. So just kill all of them. We're doing everybody basically a favor. This was outrageous, again, even by the standards of medieval combat. This is disgusting and disgraceful, and Arnaud Amaric is a priest. He is a man of peace and Christianity, and that's what he ordered everybody to do. Béziers, southern France, the place still exists today. That's the Albigensian Crusade, just massacre upon another massacre. It was one of the most brutal bits of crusading, and it wasn't against Muslims. It was against Christians with slightly different ideas, and possibly not even that. And it leads to the Siege of Toulouse. It's bloody, it's violent. Although I'm going to skim past it, I don't want you to think, oh, it wasn't as big a deal as something like the Third Crusade. Oh, definitely more people died in the Albigensian Crusade than died in most other crusades. It was an incredibly terrible period. There's another period where a whole group of people who were condemned as heretics, there was 100 of them lined up, and they were all blinded except for one man who kept one eye. And they would march along holding hands so the person at the front could lead everybody to safety. This is one of these things where, is that true? Is it a myth? But actually, when you look at medieval history, it's not beyond the cruelty of the time. The Albigensian Crusade. But let's move on to the Fifth Crusade, also declared by Innocent III, who declared more crusades than any other pope. Innocent III, for the most violent of popes. So he declared the Fifth Crusade in 1217. So this is going on the same time as Albigensian, 17 to 21. And this is going again, finally, to Egypt. Now, brilliantly, in all of this, you get St. Francis of Assisi. Yeah, that one, the famous one. He goes on the Fifth Crusade. And while they are sieging Damietta, this incredibly important fortification at the mouth of the Nile, it takes them more than a year to capture it. And they do eventually capture it. And the church bells of Europe ring, as everybody knows, what a big deal. Because once they control the mouth of the Nile, they control the trade along the Nile, and the Sultan is definitely going to have to work with them. But St. Francis of Assisi also goes along, and unbelievably, he manages to get a meeting with the Sultan, the Islamic Sultan. And his idea is he'd had a vision that he could convert the Sultan to Christianity. Now, sadly, it is not recorded what was said in that meeting, but clearly you have a serious Muslim who absolutely takes his Islamic religious principles seriously, was obviously a bit bemused by St. Francis of Assisi. We can say as these two facts, A, St. Francis failed to convert him, and B, the Sultan was polite enough not to kill him and let him go unmolested. What happens then is the crusade then starts working its way down the Nile. And there's the Battle of Mansura, where the crusaders get completely annihilated by the highly maneuverable Islamic forces. And so that's what ends it. The Christian forces are basically surrounded. The Christian forces are forced to basically pay their own ransoms. Some of them remain. When we get to the Seventh Crusade, they find some of the survivors of the Fifth Crusade still in captivity in the Seventh Crusade. That's in the early 1200s. Then we get the Sixth Crusade. That's a weird one because this is the only crusade where there's no fighting. It's from 1227 to 29. You get the emperor, the German emperor Frederick II, who at certain times in his career was excommunicated by the Pope. He turns up in the Middle East and he knows he doesn't have enough forces to really carry out a major campaign. But he also knows that the Islamic powers have no idea if there are more Christians coming. And certainly in the past, more Christian powers did turn up, so he could bluff it. And he does an amazing bluff. He manages to get back Jerusalem. This is the point of a crusade. And he does it without any bloodshed. This looks good to the 21st century. But because he didn't capture it by force, the walls have to be torn down. There's restrictions as to how many Christian forces can actually be there at any given point. But he does get it back under Christian control. But he's widely condemned by this because he doesn't go toe-to-toe. But he manages to complete more than what the second, third, fourth, and fifth crusades had managed to do, and he did it using his brain. Frederick II is also referred to as Stupor Mundi, which means wonder of the world, and he's an amazing, he's almost like a Renaissance prince in the Middle Ages. He is a remarkable man who managed to make far more enemies than friends, and indeed he was condemned for mission accomplished on the Sixth Crusade. But again, it's another sign of how the Christians didn't just instantly kill the Muslims. There was discussion, negotiation, and sometimes mutual respect on both sides. Seventh Crusade, 1248 to 1254, we get Louis the Ninth. He is one of the sainted kings of France. He goes on the Seventh Crusade, and they manage to capture Damietta again very quickly, going well. As they're marching down through the Nile Delta, however, you get the Sultan opening up the floodgates and flooding it, and the crusade gets bogged down. They can't move any further in all of the flooded areas, flooded fields. So they get captured, including Louis the Ninth. And it's during this time that the elite forces, the Mamluk forces, these are Christian boys who are converted to Islam and then made the elite troops. So they're not Arabs, they're not Muslims. They become Muslim and they have been the backbone of Islamic forces for more than a century. But the Mamluks rise up, they carry out a palace coup, and literally in Chuanville, one of the chroniclers of the Seventh Crusade, the crusaders literally saw the final sultan being killed in front of them. He manages to sort of run away from them. They throw a lance, a spear into his side, which slows him down. And I always remember, this is so vivid, he holds up his hand to kind of just as a reaction to protect himself from the scimitar coming down. And the scimitar goes between his second and third fingers, and the blade goes from that point all the way down to his elbow. So it basically cleaves his arm in half, and he obviously dies. And we now have the Mamluks, and one of the Mamluks actually goes up to the King of France and says to him, do you want to be next, kind of thing. But they negotiate a settlement, they get out of there, but the Mamluks now become the premier power in Egypt and then on into the Middle East. However, again, something that's completely forgotten, just after this, we get the Mongols exploding into the Middle East. In 1258, they besiege Baghdad. And because the last caliph of the Islamic world, he's based in Baghdad, and he manages to insult the Mongols, never a good idea, but also he doesn't rally an army and he doesn't properly prepare the city for a siege. This is a disaster waiting to happen. When the Mongols do get into Baghdad in 1258. So there's a period in Islamic culture referred to as the Golden Age. This is where they come up with amazing advances in mathematics and astronomy and chemistry and philosophy, all these kinds of things. And it starts round about 800. There's a little bit of a debate about that, but 800 tends to be the debatable start. But there's no debate when it ends, because that's 1258 and the Mongol siege of Baghdad. The River Tigris nearby Baghdad runs for days black, not with blood, but with ink, with all the books the Mongols throw into it. The amount of people massacred is at least 300,000. This is the one time where the Mongols might have gone a little bit too far, even for them, as the charnel house of massacring and death and destruction and corpses everywhere led to them camping outside the city. And there's another horrible fact of the cobblestones of Baghdad was slippery with human fat. So that's what happens when you annoy the Mongols. So that's 1258, and the Mongols head into the Middle East. Now, to be clear from the Mongol perspective, they do not send in their main army. They send in a guy called Hulagu and he is one of the Mongol royal family, but he's coming in with maybe one or two Tumans, so that's 10 or 20,000. This is a reconnaissance in force rather than an entire invasion army. But this Mongol force comes in, and by now the Mongols have also attacked Europe. They are referred to as Gog and Magog. These are these demonic giants in some biblical stories. And so they're seen as the Antichrist. And we get this amazing moment where the remaining lands in the Middle East, they have this dichotomy. The Mamluks say, we have an army to fight these Mongols. So fundamentally, the Mamluks are the local enemy. But you've also got the Mongols, which seem to be an existential enemy. Do you let the Mamluks go through unmolested through your Christian territories to fight the Mongols or not? You think about that for a moment. Well, the answer is, in 1260, the Mamluks were allowed through and they face the Mongols. In 1260, there's the Battle of Ayn Jalut, which if you translate it, it's the Well of Goliath. So there's another biblical implication. And the Battle of Ayn Jalut is the first time in Mongol history where a Mongol army is defeated in battle. Now, it's a very close-run thing, but the Mongols are pushed back. However, what it does do is it shows that the Mamluks are now the premium power in the Middle East. And so, fast-forwarding, we get to 1270 and the Eighth Crusade. Now, it's interesting, there's an argument about, is it the Eighth Crusade and then the Ninth Crusade, or is it the Eighth Crusade Part 1 and Part 2? But we get Louis the Ninth again. And they figure, well, if we land in Tunisia, we'll be able to attack Egypt from that direction and we'll do brilliantly. Now, medieval maps weren't great, and we now know that Tunisia is quite a long way away from Egypt, but they thought it was a lot closer, and they land, and nothing happens apart from Louis the Ninth dies of illness, and then a lot of the French forces just go home. However, the remaining forces are led by Prince Edward of England, who will become Edward I of England. And so he takes the remaining forces from Tunisia to the remaining Christian lands in the Middle East. And he spends a couple of years there reinforcing them against the oncoming onslaught of the Mamluks. He also manages to broker a peace treaty. Again, the Mamluks don't know if there are going to be more Christian forces turning up. So a bit like Richard, he does quite a lot with not as much resources as was ever planned. And he definitely keeps it going for a little while longer. However, we then get to the end game in the Middle East in the 1290s. Where we get the Mamluks just rolling everything up. They take Antioch and massacre everybody in it. The final battle is the Siege of Acre, and the Mamluks manage to break in and capture that as well. By then, you've got the Christians now in charge of places like Cyprus, so there is still presence in the sphere of the Middle East, but the next time you get Jerusalem being captured by Christian forces is by the British Army in World War I. So we are now obviously way past the era. There are future crusades. Like I say, up in the north, those go on for centuries. And there are various calls to crusades as the Ottoman Empire, the Islamic power that comes from the power vacuum at the end of the Crusader era, it starts spreading into Europe. So in the 1300s and on into the 1400s, for example, just throw this out there, there's the Crusade of Varna from 1443 to 1444. And its entire point is to stop Ottoman expansion in the Balkans, and fails. But these rather defensive attacks on a different continent are very different to the idea of what the original crusade was. As I said in part one, to make a crusade, you need the backing of the church, and also the church allows you to raise funds. That is referred to as a papal bull. The last time a papal bull was raised for funds for a crusading concept was during the Spanish Civil War in the 1930s, for the Royalists, for the record. Well, the Republicans were hardly going to back the Pope, are they? Nobody seriously is calling the Spanish Civil War a crusade, but it just shows you how long it took for Europe to shrug off this idea. It is used in games today, it's being used in video games, it's being used in culture, and it's fascinating. The Crusades aren't an alien part of European history. They're actually a fundamental part of European history. Whatever you may think of religion, for example, you cannot understand any country's history without understanding the religious imperatives that coursed through the culture and the politics of the time. And the Crusades were a going concern in the Middle East for 200 years and were a going concern in Northern Europe and other places for centuries after that. I really hope you enjoyed this two-parter. Let me know what you thought of it. I'm at Jem Deducci on Twitter and Threads. If you got further questions, oh, again, quick plug. If you want to know more about any of this stuff, read Deus Vult, A Concise History of the Crusades. That's my very first published book. Really proud of it. It takes you through all these different eras. It goes into more depth, obviously. Also tells you about a few other battles and a few other different times of crusading as well. It's also there in my book, The Sultans, which is about Ottoman history. I really see The Sultans as a sequel to Deus Vult, because the last chapter of Deus Vult, I take bits of that and it's part of the first chapter of The Sultans, because as I just said a couple of minutes ago, the Ottoman Empire is created in the vacuum of the collapse of the Mongol Empire and the Mamluks not being able to spread their influence on into Anatolia and the Christians not being around. So had there not been this political chaos, probably the Ottoman Empire wouldn't have started in the first place. And as I just showed you, a century into the Ottoman experience, you still got Westerners claiming crusades against the Ottomans. So yes, it's a continuation by other means. So if you want to know more about it, have a look at those two books is what I would say. Thanks very much. Another episode coming soon.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.